Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. The lawsuit challenging Arizona's new minimum wage law had its first day in court today. Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services was there and joins me now. And Howie, what happened?
Essentially, the judge got a chance to hear the first arguments on whether, in fact, what voters approved last month is legal. The challengers, including the Arizona Chamber and other business interests, wanted him to enter an immediate temporary restraining order, saying, in essence, you know, businesses need some assurance that they don't have to start laying off people this weekend. And the judge said, no, wait a second. I haven't even heard any evidence. So what Judge Daniel Kiley did is he set a hearing on an injunction for this coming Tuesday where he wants to hear the full-blown arguments.
At that time, will he just rule on the injunction, or could he also potentially rule on the actual merits of the case?
Well, to the extent that he rules on the injunction, he has done that, because under Arizona law, in order to get an injunction, you not only have to show hardship and potential harm, but you also have to show that you're likely to win ultimately in the end after a full-blown hearing. So if he were to issue an injunction, he'd basically be saying, yes, I think that what voters approved was illegal, in which case we know that the Pro 206 folks will go running to the Supreme Court. If alternately he says, no, I don't see any problems here, we know that the business interest will then run off to the Supreme Court to seek their intervention.
Let's talk about some of the arguments in this case. This case was filed yesterday by the Arizona Chamber of Commerce, the Phoenix Chamber of Commerce, a few other chambers of commerce, and others. Why are they saying that this new minimum wage law is unconstitutional?
They basically have two arguments. Number one, there is a constitutional provision that says if you vote to require some new expenditure, you're supposed to have a dedicated source of revenues to cover it. So, for example, if the voters wanted to say, we want to put $1 million a year into anti-smoking efforts, you'd have to identify a new tax, perhaps a tax on tobacco or something, to raise that $1 million. The argument here is that there will be costs to the state from this, mainly in the sense that the Arizona Healthcare Cost Containment System is looking at paying more to its providers for developmentally disabled, because they're going to have to increase what they pay their employees. Now, the counter argument by the Pro 206 folks is that nothing in their measure actually mandates the state reimburse the providers. Yes, it's too bad the providers might have to eat the difference, but there is no mandate here. So that's part of what the judge will decide. The other half of that is that the remedy, assuming there were actually a cost to the state, is that the state does not have to fund it. There is nothing in the statute or in the Constitution that says if you don't have a dedicated funding source, the whole measure goes away. There's also a separate legal argument about that there were actually two measures in there, one to raise the minimum wage, the other on mandatory paid time off, and that they should have been addressed separately. That's going to be an interesting question for the judge to address.
Howie, obviously we're running up on some deadlines. This new minimum wage is set to take effect New Year's Day, just a couple of weeks left. And as you reference, we could be looking at this case as well as an appeal to the Supreme Court.
Oh, definitely. We know whoever loses will take the case to the Supreme Court. Now, the question of how quickly the justices can act, particularly with Christmas coming up, is an interesting one, because we've got some questions there that clearly businesses need to have resolved. They need to know, should they be laying off people now because they can't afford going from $8.05 an hour now to $10 an hour on January 1st and maybe $12 an hour in 2020. The other interesting question is, the two new justices that the governor just named are going to be sworn in on Monday. Do they take part, and how do they tip the balance of equities at the state's high court?
Interesting stuff. That's Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Howie, thanks as always.
You're very welcome.
Immigration reform was a significant and controversial issue during the presidential race, and now a group of conservative leaders from across the state has formed a new coalition in an effort to inform that debate going forward. It's called Partnership for a New American Economy of Arizona, and State Representative Tony Rivero is its co-chair. And Tony, tell me about this new group. What are your goals?
Well, First and foremost, we recognize that immigration is a big issue facing the country. We've been discussing this for the last decade. The goal is to join as business leaders, political leaders, as community leaders, and come together and try to work with members of Congress, the community, and the new administration and press them to make sure that they work on immigration reform, because it's something that I believe our communities want, and it's in the best interest of this country to get this issue solved.
Obviously, there are lots of different ideas for how to deal with immigration reform. What specifically would you like to see happen?
What I would like to see, it's three components, very high-level components. First, every sovereign country in the world has a right to secure its borders. So a big emphasis has to be placed at the border. Two, what do we do with the people who are here illegally? I think everybody agrees that the people who are criminals, people who are coming here to commit crimes, they need to go. Now, the rest of the people who are here working hard, who have families, we need to come up with a system. I know that there's different options that people have presented. One of the options has been, well, let's just give them visas. Others have said, well, let's only give them green cards. Some have said, let's create a pathway to citizenship. At the end of the day, I'm open to all three. And the reason for that is my goal is to protect families. We don't want to have people in this country, in the state of Arizona, worrying that while they drive to work, they're going to be pulled over and then deported. So that's my concern as a state representative. And the last component that I've been discussing for the last 6 years as an elected official is we don't want to be in this situation again in 5 years or in 10 years. And I believe we have to have serious consideration on what we do with visas going forward. My goal here is if we increase the number of visas based on the economy, we incentivize people to come to this country legally versus illegally. And at the end of the day, I think increasing the number of visas also helps secure the border, because I think people will then be incentivized to do it the legal way.
When you talk about increasing visas, are you thinking like high-skilled type visas for companies like Intel, which obviously have a big presence here in Arizona? Are you thinking like some kind of guest worker program to help some of the agricultural interests in Yuma?
I think a combination. I think we need to have these specific groups sitting at the table. Obviously, they know their needs better, but there's a need. That's why people are coming here. There's a need for work, and I think increasing visas has to be looked at, and it could be triggered by the economy. If the economy is doing well and we need more workers, the visas go up. So it could be triggered by the economy.
What methods would you like to see used to secure the border? I mean, do you think a big wall, as the president-elect has suggested, is the way to go?
I disagree with the big wall. The first thing here is over 50% of the people who are here illegally came legally with a visa, and they overstayed. That's the first thing. Second thing is, I believe 40% of the people who are here didn't come from Mexico. So it doesn't make sense for this country to invest billions of dollars on a wall when a big majority of the people who are coming here legally. We have to have a system that tracks the visas when people come in on a tourist visa, making sure that there's an exit point. But I don't think spending resources on building a wall from side to side is the right way to go. I think it could be done through technology, through drones, and other aspects.
What would you like to see happen with the group of people who have been come to known as the Dreamers?
For me, on the Dreamer issue, it's a no-brainer. First and foremost, it's the right thing to do.
To let them stay.
Yeah, to let them stay. Second, we've educated most of them, K-12. A lot of them have gone on to go to college. These are kids who are ambitious. These are kids who work hard. It doesn't make sense to invest in them and then say, well, you can't participate in our economy. You can't participate in our country. You have to go.
Do you believe that this is an issue that should, by and large, be taken up by the federal government as opposed to states passing their own laws?
Absolutely. And the reason for that is this issue impacts the entire country, and we need uniformity across the country.
Are you concerned that some members of your own party don't agree with that?
Well, we're always open to that debate, and I'll be working with some of my colleagues here at the state legislature, and it's a debate that's worth having. I know that there were some bills that were introduced, that were debated in committee, that were debated in the floor, and a combination of Republicans and Democrats were able to defeat it, including myself. I joined that group. So I'm a strong believer that at the state we'll continue fighting that battle.
State Representative Tony Rivero is co-chair of Partnership for a New American Economy of Arizona, which calls itself a conservative coalition for immigration reform.
President-elect Donald Trump appears to have fossil fuels on his mind as he makes his cabinet picks. The governor of Texas at the Department of Energy, an ExxonMobil CEO running the State Department, and Oklahoma's Attorney General for the Environmental Protection Agency. But where do renewables like solar energy fit into this conservative agenda? KJZZ's Will Stone reports.
Take a walk around Charlie Miller's neighborhood, and it quickly becomes a sales pitch.
Mine's had it for 5.5 years. This one's had it for 5 years.
He's talking about solar panels.
That one is brand new. Down the street, there's about 4 more.
And that's just one block in Pebble Creek, a retirement community west of Phoenix with over 4,000 homes, 25% with rooftop solar.
You do one solar house. He plays golf with his friend. His friend's all upset. He got a $450 bill, and he says, oh, geez, mine's 30. It's contagious.
Miller moved to Arizona just as rooftop solar was taking off. Now he works for a local installer. Plenty of homeowners in sunshine plus high summer bills all explain why solar makes so much sense in Pebble Creek, a solidly Republican area.
When you go into these houses, you don't need to talk anybody into solar. And we have as many conservatives in here or more. They ready for solar?
In fact, Miller goes to local Republican clubs spreading the doctrine of solar, a doctrine shared by some prominent Republicans here.
Conservatives should be on top of this because of freedom of choice.
That's former Congressman Barry Goldwater Jr.
Choice in education, choice in health care. This is just another choice of where you get your energy from.
Goldwater chairs an advocacy group called Tell Utilities Solar Won't Be Killed. He says his party and that of his father's hasn't done enough for solar in Arizona. The utilities wield a lot of influence, he says, and are not a fan of competition.
And that's what renewable energy is to a utility, because utility has a business plan that is basically a dinosaur. They're not open for new ideas.
Of course, utilities don't see it that way. Distributed energy, like rooftop solar, reduces customers' reliance on the grid, at least during the day. That lowers bills, as does net metering, which reimburses customers at retail rates for their extra power. Arizona's largest utility, APS, is trying to pay solar customers less for that energy, claiming it's caused a $1 billion cost shift onto all its other customers. And that makes solar socially and economically unjust, says Paul Walker with Conserve America, a conservative conservation group.
And as the wealthy homes move off of the system, they're leaving more and more of the fixed costs for the people that couldn't afford to get solar in the first place.
He says utilities recognize that and are trying to correct the problem, not kill clean energy.
We see that in a lot of the PR, where there's talk about a war on solar, and I just haven't ever seen anything that really shows Arizona utilities are opposed to solar.
In fact, he points to a new program in the state that he dubs blue-collar solar. Instead of customers investing in a big solar system, the utility owns the panels and pays a fixed monthly rate for the roof space.
The common reason why for going solar is really economics.
James Tong is with a California-based group called Advanced Grid Consulting. He spoke via Skype.
It's not necessarily the tree hugger that actually goes solar.
He studied the demographics of solar customers and says political persuasion isn't necessarily a good indicator of who buys in.
They both see solar as a means to freedom from monopoly, but the conservative sees it as a more of a way to protect their individual freedom, whereas the liberal may see it as, well, we're protecting the environment, which is more of a collective freedom.
And attitudes seem to be changing. Polling shows more Republicans are worried about climate change in recent years, and 75% of Trump voters would like to increase renewable energy. Here's Conserve America's Paul Walker again.
That doesn't fit with what most people think is true about conservatives or about Trump supporters, but we're seeing that more and more and more.
And even under a Trump administration, the market for renewables will continue to grow because costs have come down so much. And you have conservative enthusiasts like Charlie Miller back in Pebble Creek.
It's a good investment, but it's also good for the earth. I mean, we're making energy here with no emissions.
He and other Republicans on the ground in red, sunny states like Arizona will be making their case for more energy choices. Will Stone, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In the last 15 years, the number of newborns that end up in intensive care because of their mother's substance abuse went up. 250% up. It's just one of the many sad statistics produced by the nation's opioid crisis. There's a term for what these babies are going through, neonatal abstinence syndrome, essentially babies going through withdrawal from drugs they absorbed in utero. At McGee Women's Hospital in Pittsburgh, volunteers hold these babies as they go through withdrawal. In the hospital, the staff calls them the cuddlers.
When I get here in the morning, I'd never know for sure how many babies are going to be there. Sometimes I walk in to the NICU and I can hear crying, so I know somebody's going to need my attention right away. Thank you. My name is Beverly Thornton, and I'm a baby cuddler. Once you've been doing this for a while, you can kind of sense that, maybe this baby just wants a pacifier. She's sleeping, sort of, but she's waking up a little bit, and she really just needs a pacifier. She's not ready, really, to be cuddled at that point. So sometimes you try that, and if that stops and she goes back to sleep, then you go on to another baby. No matter how much the baby seems to be struggling or what a tough time they're having, I can always look at the monitor and see that I've had an impact. When they get very agitated or their heart rate goes up very high, but usually within a certain amount of time, if you're holding the baby and you find just the right position, sometimes the challenge is finding the right position because every baby's different, you can see the monitor go down and their heart rate kind of slows down. Just relax. You're going home today. I remember lots of them for different reasons. You know, some of them seem to be having a much harder time and needed a little more time with me. I may go in one day and I hold the same baby for the entire shift. Other days I may hold three babies or four babies. It just depends. But I don't remember them by name necessarily. I just remember the experience with them. Mm-hmm. There you go. There you go. Just relax. Everybody talks these days about being fully present and, you know, kind of living in the moment. There aren't too many activities that I'm involved in where I'm totally focused on just one thing. I'm a multitasker. My whole life I've been a multitasker. And I can say that this is the one thing that I do where from the time I walk into the NICU until the time I walk out, nothing else matters other than that baby that I'm holding. And while their monitors are going down, you know, probably if I had a monitor on, mine would probably be going down as well, because you're relaxed, but you're focused on them.
You want a little more if you want?
Sarah Schneider produced this piece for our partners at The Pulse. She's a reporter with public radio station WESA in Pittsburgh. The new Star Wars movie Rogue One opened today with, of course, much fanfare, and a Valley auction house is hoping to capitalize on that with a sizable collection going up for bid tomorrow. With me to explain is Jimmy Garcia, director of operations at EJ's Auction and Consignments in Glendale. And Jimmy, it sounds like you've got a big themed auction going on tomorrow?
We do. A phenomenal, great collection of Star Wars memorabilia, from toys to signed autographs and cardboard cutouts.
Yeah, what kinds of things are in this collection?
We've got some original 1977 toys that came out, still in original packaging. We've got some comic books, like I said, some movie premiere or run-throughs of the cardboard cutouts. Just over 10,000 pieces, honestly.
How does that size compare to the typical kind of collections that you auction off?
Honestly, it's probably one of the largest we've ever seen come through.
Really?
We've seen Star Wars, we've seen Disney, we've seen other stuff, but this thing, I mean, we filled up a 26-foot box truck from floor to ceiling, front to back.
Wow. Do you think that just speaks to the popularity of this movie franchise?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it doesn't lose traction. The fan base is always there.
Is this collection all from one person's personal collection?
Can you believe it? One person.
Wow. One person had 10,000 items.
and more. We've got a second run of the second part. We'll be running December 31st, which will include another bulk of the collection. It's going to be more of the loose toys, but that's going to have its own particular gems as well.
Do you have an estimate of how many pieces are in that collection?
I think in total we're looking at probably 25,000.
25,000, wow. Yeah.
I mean, they were so much so that they loved Star Wars so much, they collected even, you know, the Taco Bell lids when they have their promotions. Just because it said Star Wars on it. The receipts, because it said Star Wars. The Coke caps, it said Star Wars. They were staying in the collection.
Well, are people going to buy that? Or is somebody going to buy a Taco Bell receipt because it said Star Wars on it?
Believe it or not, we've sold it in the past.
Really?
Yes.
To whom? Like, who comes to these auctions and buys, not so much like the collectibles, but like a Coke, a soda bottle can or something, a lid or something.
Right. And we won't sell it by itself. We'll obviously combine it with other stuff that will increase its value or make it so a bidder will enjoy it, not just because it's that. But fans that are just, hardcore fans, they love it. Anything that has to do with Star Wars, that's what it is. And any other genre, that would fall into it.
Do you have an estimate as to how much you are appraising this collection at? Like, what's this thing worth?
Thousands. Thousands. I mean, you've got single pieces that range a few thousand dollars for a small figurine to a few bucks, So, for example, we've got a Millennium Falcon. You could have bought that at Toys R Us for $100, and we definitely expect anywhere in the range from $600 to $800.
So, how much do you expect to make off this auction, given what you think it's valued at?
It'd probably do anywhere in the range. I'm going to estimate it around $35,000, $40,000, if not more.
That's a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Certainly is.
How optimistic are you that by tying this auction into the release of this new movie, that might bump up interest and bump up sales a little bit?
It certainly is going to help, honestly, and it just came. We got this collection about 2 weeks ago, so it just kind of fell in our laps here, and we said, absolutely, it's fantastic, and it just couldn't come at a better time.
Jimmy Garcia with EJ's Auction and Consignment, a very, very large auction going on tomorrow of Star Wars collectibles and other memorabilia. Jimmy, thanks a lot.
You got it. Thanks, Mark.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.